Welcome to the Blame Free State Telecourse. During this five-class course, we'll be putting our attention at the very heart of the whole nonviolence movement. When Marshall chose the name nonviolent communication, he did it because he wanted to be aligned with the nonviolence movement, mostly the work of Martin Luther King and Gandhi. And of course, Gandhi was doing his work in India. And in the language in Hindi, the word for nonviolence is ahimsa, ahimsa. And there's also another translation of the word ahimsa, which is state of the heart that has no enemies. State of the heart that has no enemies. So during this course, we'll be learning how to get in that state. And for me, it is extremely important. I often say what I'll say now, which is that I believe that the skill of being able to open our hearts, to move away from blame, is the most important skill ever. That if we were to choose only one skill, that by far it would be the one that I would choose. So it's important for all kind of reasons, and I'll name just a few for now. The first one is that it's important for our relationships. Let's imagine our lives without our relationships. Like, it's almost unimaginable. Like, relationships are so, so important, so meaningful. And blame is one of the top reasons why relationships can be damaged. Sitting very close to the top, if not at the top. Either a relationship with others and relationships with ourselves. So that's the first reason. The second reason why it's so important, at least to me, is that has to do with our empowerment. Because when we blame others or ourselves or the situations that we're in, who has the power? We disempower ourselves through blame, unless we know how to work with blame, which is what we're going to learn through this five-class course. The third reason is simply our health. Because when we are blaming, it usually involves a higher level of stress. And stress is one of the main things that impacts our health. Stress is known to cause or make worse 70% of illnesses. So that's one reason why it's important to have an understanding in a way out of blame, simply for our health. And the last one I want to mention for now is has to do with our in-the-moment experience. When I started studying nonviolent communication, I was struck with Marshall talking about the divine energy, and it sounded a bit weird, actually. I was like, divine energy, what is it about then? But I really got it when I started to be in empathy with others and open my heart, and it did feel pretty divine, especially compared to what I would call jackal energy when we're in this kind of dark place, blaming others, unhappy with what's going on. So definitely it felt even more divine compared to that other experience. So a reason to be on top of the blame game, so to speak, has to do with our in-the-moment experience, because it feels so much better to have our hearts open, at least for myself and many people I've been talking to through the years, because I've been exploring and sharing about this work for many years now. I consider it my life's work, like the most important thing that I've been working on since I've been involved with NVC, and that's why I choose that as the topic for my first book. So for today, we'll dive in exploring what is the cost of blame. We'll talk about enemy images, and the bulk of the call will be focused on how to dissolve or transform enemy images of others. And there's a six-step process that we'll do together. We might not be able to complete it because I want to leave room for questions, but it's not a problem. If we don't complete it, we'll complete it on the next call. So we'll just see how it goes. I still want it to be spacious, but really depends on how that works out. All right, so tiny bit of logistics first. It would be really helpful if you could have access to the documents, two of these documents. One is a list of feelings and needs. The other one is a Word document that ideally you would have access to on your computer. I mean, it's also possible to print it. If you can work with it on the computer during the class, would be awesome. And if you can print it and work on it, that works well. If you don't have access to it, I'll find a way to guide you anyway so you can follow the class. So don't worry about it if you don't have access to it. So for this five-class series, today, as I mentioned, we'll focus mostly on dissolving enemy images of others. The next call, the main focus will be dissolving enemy images of ourselves. The third call will be working with enemy images of the situations that we're in. Call number four will be about what can we learn from blame. And how can we transform the blame that we receive from others? And the last call will be working with our fears of being blamed. We're diving in the question of the blame-free state. So first, what does it mean to be in the blame-free state? Being in the blame-free state means being able to transform or diminish any sense of wrongness about self, others, or the situations that we're in. So that's the first part. It also means that we know how to navigate being blamed by others, and that we learn how to free ourselves from what I call blame-avoiding behaviors. These things that we do to avoid being blamed. And I'm smiling now because when I started exploring that, I found so many things that I'm doing to avoid blame, and I was not aware of that at all. It might not be like huge things, but certainly it was impacting. I hope I'm getting better now, but it was impacting a lot of my decisions in a subtle way sometimes or big ways other times. So I'm really excited about that part as well. So that being said, let's explore what is the cost of blame? And I'd like to hear from some of you. Like earlier on, I told you the reasons why it can benefit to move out of blame. But let's, for a moment, look at what is the cost of blame, and mostly from our own experience, when we are blaming others, what is the cost of blame? And that could also include receiving blame, but let's spend some time just on clarifying that. If you have the mic.
Mine first was just a loss of connection to the person, a loss of the human experience that we usually might feel with them.
Thank you. Yes, it's like at this point when blame is present, we are separate. So yes, there's a loss of connection and all that can come out from that connection. I like how you put it, like the human experience that we might feel with them. And so we are in a place of separation. Which, by the way, is one of the main causes of violence, is that experience of separation. And this is something I heard from Miki Kashan, which is talking about one book, I think, written by Sherif Abdullah, which, if I'm correct, is The World That Works for All. And he did a huge study about to find the causes of violence. He found around 50 causes. Then it boiled down to two main reasons, and the separation was the first one, the other one being scarcity. So yes, when there's blame, we lose the connection. Thanks a lot. You have the mic.
When I'm in a blame state, whether I'm being blamed or I'm blaming others, I erect walls around me, and
yeah.
Then I start a very vicious circle, which seems to have no end, because then the blame starts from the other side, and then I lose my creativity, I
yeah.
lose my sense of balance, I'm only concentrating on finding all the reasons now to throw the ball back in court to blame again.
Thank you. I couldn't agree more. And again, the image that you brought was I erect a wall around me. So that is the separation. That's the end of the togetherness with a wall. And then, yeah, the vicious cycle. This is something actually I talk a lot about. My claim is that there's no neutral in life in general. That we're either in the vicious cycle where things get harder and harder, you know, worse and worse, or the virtuous cycle when things get better and better. So everything we do has the potential to bring us in one of these cycles, and definitely blame has the potential to sort of make our world smaller and keeps us in this jackal energy, and things can get harder and harder, and we're more and more separate. We're more and more alone, more lost. Our energy goes down. Oftentimes it's hard to sleep. Then if we don't sleep, it's hard to think through things well. We don't want to ask for support, and on and on and on and on. So absolutely, thanks for naming it. And that's certainly what brought me to doing this work. Many years ago, I was noticing being so unhappy with the way things were working in my own mind when I started NBC, and just being upset at my wife and at my son, like, was so unpleasant that I totally wanted to move out of that. So I explored all kind of ways. I so wanted to be free from that. And one thing that I was doing every day for multiple months was to take a walk, and in that walk, I would dissolve enemy images of my son and of my wife, even if there was no specific issues. I just got in the habit of doing that every day. So I wanted to integrate it. I really wanted to live from that place of an open heart. And it actually worked. I managed to get faster and faster and have all kind of subtleties and different processes. And I couldn't be more grateful for that. And really grateful to Marshall for bringing the whole NBC consciousness to me, because it's just completely changed my life. Like, before NBC, I was having conflicts in so many places. I was in musical groups and conflicts here, conflicts with my wife. Like, just, I mean, not more than average people, but I mean, it's just tainted my life in a way that I was so unhappy with. So, all right. Thank you. So I think we're clear enough on the cost of blame. So, let's talk about enemy images. At the heart of blame, when we blame, there's what we call, what I call, enemy image. The definition that I have, an enemy image can be described as a sustained blame that we hold, or a persistent negative idea of someone else, ourselves, groups, could be animals, could be objects, or any similar things or situations as well. So a sustained blame that we hold, a persistent negative idea or of someone else or any of these things that I mentioned. So now, what's a little bit paradoxical here is that I also believe that we can have almost like spontaneous enemy images, like they're not sustained. They're not persistent. They just happen. Like, someone cuts us on the road. Like, a driver comes and just sort of cuts us. We've never seen that person, and we won't see that person again. But in the moment, we're upset and probably filled with blame and maybe fears as well. But the blame is there. So for me, that's still an enemy image. And as a general rule, an enemy image is something that is sustained, that is there for a long time. Also, some people sometimes ask, what's the difference between an enemy image and a judgment? There's not a huge difference. It's pretty similar, although an enemy image, it has a different feel because it usually stays for a while. And I don't want to get lost in vocabulary, whether it's judgment or enemy image, but in case you're wondering, it is not a big difference. But for the course, I'm talking about enemy images. So let's start learning how to dissolve enemy images. And I always start with working with enemy images of others. So first, why do we blame others? There could be all kind of ways, and there are various reasons, but I believe that the main reason that we blame others is to protect ourselves from the pain related to the underlying blame that we have for ourselves in relation to any specific situation. I'll say it again. I believe that if we blame others, it's because that's a way to protect ourselves. I'm saying that really often there's a blame towards ourselves that we don't want to see. It's too hard. too dangerous, too scary. So then we turn that energy outwards, and we blame someone else. So we, if something happens, we feel pain. We don't know how to take responsibility, and we're not used to it. And oftentimes the culture doesn't help. Like I would say, in most movies or TV shows, at least produced in America, there's so much fingers pointing, there's so much blame flying, that we're kind of immersed in that kind of culture. So we just don't know how to do better. So then we take that energy and we point it towards someone else. So then that person is responsible. So therefore, we don't have to go into self-doubts. We don't have to go into self-doubt and feel the pain about what might mean that there's something's wrong with us. Most people carry some version of the belief that something's wrong with me or that I'm not good enough. It's almost, sometimes I say it's like gravity, like it's like it affects almost everyone. So then if something happens and you were to add even more evidence that there's something wrong with you, this could be dangerous. It could stop you from being functional. So therefore, and like I said, added with the culture of what's happening, we immediately turn it outwards towards other people. As I said, they could be all kind of other reasons, but that's the one that's the most interesting to me. That's the one that I found the most liberating for myself. And again, the assumption is that under blame for someone else, there's a blame for ourselves. And if I believe we sort of fool ourselves when we put the problem out there. We could save a lot of time just working on what are we blaming ourselves for directly. And this is what we'll do through the course. Like we'll start, move from blame towards others, then bring it to ourselves. So how to do it? And actually, let me pause here a little bit because, of course, I'm excited and I have a lot to say. And I want to leave room for comments or questions at any point and spaces. So if you have any comments or questions at this point, been talking about the cost of blame, enemy images, and then my assumption that there's usually an underlying blame for ourselves, under blame for others. All right, you have the mic. Yes.
What came to my mind is I had heard from someone, a psychologist person, who said that blaming other people was better than blaming yourself. And so I was just wondering if you're going to speak to how people do use that, do blame other people and protect themselves, because it's been shown that it's actually psychologically better for you to do that.
I mean, it's pretty aligned with what I was just talking about, like that's why we blame others, is to protect ourselves. Whether it's better, that's an assumption that I don't share personally, but I could see that, yes, there's a real cost of blaming ourselves in terms of self-esteem and all that can mean. And obviously for me is to find a way to transform the blame for others, the blame for ourselves, so it becomes something that is life-serving. And I sort of respect that opinion, but for me, what's most important is to understand the reason. So then if we understand the reason, we can be more at choice and decide where we put our energy. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I like where you're going with this. That was just a question in my mind that's been in my mind for a long time, because I'm more of a blame self person. There was some study done, and that most successful people, type A's, or I don't know, those people who are out there making the things happen that we mostly think about as being out there making it happen, are blaming other people over blaming themselves, is what the study was saying.
Yeah, I hear you totally. It's something interesting for me to hear. I didn't hear it. Like I said, it makes sense to me that blaming ourselves would be more costly. And I mean, we'll look at it next call. There's a lot of cost to blaming ourselves. And for me, I want to transform both of them, and I think you're aligned with me on this, yeah?
I am.
All right, thank you. All right, you have the mic. Yes.
But I'm curious about, like, righteous anger, if that's different. Like, if you're really upset because somebody did something hurtful, how does that fit in to the picture? So sometimes people do really hurtful things.
Yes, not for
like
sure.
The result, whatever the needs are, the result is painful.
Yes, thank you. It's a very interesting question, and for me, it still fits under the same category, and at the same time, it's a different treatment. That's why, let's say for today, we will work with enemy images that are not like extreme ones. Like I'll ask you to choose something that is a 3 on a scale from 1 to 10, 10 being like the maximum enemy image you could have of someone. When we go to extremes, it's same principle, but it we attend to it differently because it's so delicate, it's so complex. And at the same time, the principle is that when we are angry and we're blaming others, we, I believe, are not connected to our needs. We are not, I mean, we're not connected to our needs in an optimal way is what I want to say. Like we might have anger because it has to do with respecting human lives. So mm-hmm. therefore, in this way, it's connected to this need of respect. But in terms of what is the best thing to do in this situation to serve our needs and the people around, I don't think that anger, like some kind of unprocessed anger, is gonna be the best pointing arrows in terms mm-hmm. of taking life-serving actions. And even mm-hmm. if the action is really difficult and whatever it names, like violent, or it includes taking someone's life or any of the things like that, then I still believe that our work is to find a way to open our hearts and to be passionate about protecting life. Mm-hmm. So the distinction is taking action towards protection of life rather than punishment of an actor. Because I think that's where we lose ourselves. And at the same time, I agree that it's extremely challenging to do that. And still, that's the quest that I'm in, to see the humanity of any actor. And I practice every day when I hear about what happens in the news, although the news always have a way to spin things that I don't think is always the reality. But still, there are things happening. And I want to see the humanity of the person because it empowers me more that way. Does that cover a little bit what you were asking for? And does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense and it's helpful. It's more to chew on.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I mean, when we go to extremes, that's very, very, very delicate. And I want to bring a lot of compassion when we think about the difficult things that probably people on this call or listening to the recording went through. So it requires a lot of empathy, slowing down, compassion, and a lot of delicacy. So,
mm-hmm.
so.
Thank you.
Does that feel complete for now? Yeah?
Yeah, it does.
Thanks, Audrey. All right. So how to do it? Now I'm guessing that you're with me that it's important, if not crucial, to do it, at least helpful. So how to move out of enemy images of others? First, I want to be clear, it's not easy. It requires determination, skills, consciousness, patience, ability to focus, sometimes requires empathy, support, and at the same time, it's like anything else. The more you practice it, the faster you'll get at doing it. And for myself, I've been integrating it in a way I'm really happy with. And now it's pretty fast. And as I was writing the book, it was even more helpful just to put things in place and sort of see the system that is at play. So yes, difficult and worth it. And I'm pretty sure by the end of the course, and I've had people who worked with the draft of my book and went through the exercises, and they told me the same thing, that it's actually, the learning curve is kind of quick, like your brain will adjust to it and your heart as well. So difficult, but there's hope. Also, It requires physical energy, and that will be the topic of the next book that I'm writing, like the performance state. Like when we're tired, busy, and stressed, it's very difficult to do this type of work that requires so much of our spiritual presence and strength. So we need the physical resources to do that. And as you probably agree with me, when we're tired, busy, and stressed, the thoughts are oftentimes darker, and it just comes by itself in our brain, the blames and seeing scenarios of what one person did and all this kind of building on stories, building on top of stories. Just there's much more of that happening when we're tired than when we're not. So it's even more difficult. So the physical state that we're in is essential also to do that work. So how I organized it, and those of you who have the document, you will see that translated on this document, for me, it's a six-part system. And there are some variations. There's a bunch of other things that can be done, and I've been working with a lot of people, I would say at least 100 people, maybe more, helping them dissolve their enemy images of others. So there's all kind of tweaks that can happen. But in general, this is the way I see the mechanics of dissolving enemy images is organized in with this six-part system. The first one being that we need to be heard as a first thing. So it's, you know, similar to all that we know about NVC. Something happens, receiving empathy for that makes a big difference, or self-empathy, or any way to self-connect with what's going on is important to get us back to a sense of presence, because we're in shock. We're sort of vibrating. We're unstable. We're not settled. So practice of empathy from nonviolent communication, which has to do with noticing feelings and needs, makes a big difference and is very helpful. So that's the first part. The second part is what I call assuming positive intention. I'll explain a bit more what that is a bit later. The third part is rehumanization. So bring back the humanity of the person that we see as the actor, the person who did the thing that we're not happy with, or as people who are doing restorative circles would call, like, the author of the act. So we'll rehumanize that person. The fourth part is finding the meaning that we attach to what happened. And that is, for me, something, I don't even have words, like to train ourselves in dissociating the meaning that we attach to events is one of the most life-serving things we could think of, and I'll explain what that is. The fifth one is rewriting the story, and the last one is finding the underlying self-blame. And I want to bring your attention to the way it's organized, and this framing comes from in Balakrishnan, and one framing that I heard from her is this one, that NVC is about opening our hearts and also opening our minds. About opening our hearts and also opening our minds. And I loved it. And a lot of what I do now is oriented in this way. So in this six-part system, the first three parts have to do with opening our hearts. It has to do with just that place of compassion that can become a felt experience. Being heard, assuming positive intention, rehumanization, that's opening our hearts. The three other parts have to do with using our mind, our capacity to have discernment, the rigor of our thinking. A lot has to do with distinguishing observation from evaluations. That's really our mind that will do this work. So we need both. We need both the mind and the heart working together to bring us to in that state of the blame-free state. So the fourth, fifth, and sixth have to do with opening our minds, rewriting the story, finding the underlying blame, finding the meaning, and a couple of other things that we'll talk about later. So let's start with being heard. And before that, what I'd like you to do is to find one enemy image that you have of someone. So we'll work with that image for the rest of the call. If it's easy, just go for it. And again, actually, I suggest that you choose not the biggest enemy image that you have, but go gradually. Now choose one. This is a 3 on a scale from 1 to 10. Not something major. Something that is sort of persistent, like it's not just a small thing, but at the same time, it's not at the end of the scale. So find someone of whom you have an enemy image, a specific person, and also find a specific situation, something that happened. And recall the event, the specific clip of what happened, because for this type of work, it doesn't function to have generalization or vague type of assessment of a person or a situation. We need a specific person and a specific situation. So I'll put music for 1 minute. So for each of you, you find time to just choose one person and one specific situation. So, in a minute, I'll leave some time as well for yourself to get into a space of self-empathy with yourself. And if you're familiar with self-empathy, just go for it. If you're not familiar with self-empathy, the basic way to move in that direction of self-empathy is to think about how you felt and what you needed at the moment of the specific situation that you recalled. Find what could be the feelings and what could be the needs that were present for you in that situation. And to help illustrate that, I'd like to work with one of you who's on the call to demonstrate that very quickly. So I'd like to work with that person throughout the call as well to demonstrate the different steps. So I'd like to work with one of you who can trust themselves to be sort of fast to access their inner response and be able to be concise in the number of words, because this is really just to illustrate the mechanics, not to do the full-fledged process. So, and also someone who doesn't have, like I mentioned, not the too big enemy image. All right. Thanks for jumping in. So first I'd like to hear, what's the person that you have an enemy image of? Describe the person and also describe the situation in, 20, 30 seconds.
This person is a colleague of mine, and when he is working, he will use language I don't enjoy under his breath. Sometimes I describe it as a fire hose, more or less, and sometimes it can go on for hours.
Okay, wow, okay, great. And can you recall a specific time when that happened, specific moment, yeah?
Yes.
All right, excellent. So what I want to demonstrate now is the piece about self-empathy. So what were the main feelings, let's say two or three feelings that you can recall were present for you in that situation where your colleague was using the language that you didn't enjoy? How were you feeling, the main feelings for you in that situation?
It's sort of a feeling of pain or like anguish. It's like something really jerking you hard.
Anguish and a sense of hurt, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, right. So now the other part is to look at which needs of yours were calling for attention in such a way that it led you to have these feelings being present, these feelings of anguish and hurt. So let's start with anguish. The anguish was pointing towards which needs of yours?
Probably a need for respect, a need for reverence.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Makes total sense, yeah. And the hurt had to do with which needs of yours? Could be the same, but could be a different variation.
I think a need for calm.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, thank you. So that's what I'm asking people on the call to do. As simple as that, I'm not saying that this will solve the whole thing and you're transformed and that's it. But I'm saying that it's an essential part to do at least that, to take a moment to look at the feelings and the needs that were present in the situation. And in many cases when I work with people, I offer empathy for 5, 10, sometimes 15 minutes, sometimes more. But this is just a basic way to get started. And again, I think it's very important to be sort of surgical around that. So find the feelings first. Find the needs for each of the feelings. Because I think it's more type of precise work. For everyone, I'm inviting you to take a couple of minutes just to do that. Think about the situation. Find a couple of specific feelings that were present for you. And find the underlying needs in relation to that. And just stay with that energy, with the connecting to those feelings and needs. I'll put some music, and this will be very quick, like just a couple of minutes. Is the first thing. Take some time to connect with what was going on for us. That's part of opening our hearts. Now, continuing in that direction, we move to step two, which is finding the positive intention. And let me explain what I mean by that. When we're upset and after having at least a little bit of empathy, and I just want to repeat what I said at first, like this is not easy stuff. This can be really difficult. It's a little bit same kind of level of difficulty sometimes to do mediation between people that are upset at each other. Not an easy thing. So still, we have some empathy for ourselves. We can connect, be present for that. Now, part of opening our hearts to the other person, and by the way, it has to be an intention that we have. This is intentional, opening our hearts. Like, it might happen by itself, but usually if you were upset, it will have to be intentional for that. So part of opening our hearts has to do with looking at what might be the positive intention of the person that led them to do what they did. And again, if your mind jumps to extremes, let's not go there for now. Like I said, it's more complex. I'm happy to talk about it maybe later in the course. But for now, let's stay at sort of some sort of a mild level. What could be the positive intention? And in the document that you have, I put a bunch of examples from the book, and actually like to train myself and invite you to do the same in finding, being clear is what could be a negative intention, a neutral intention, and a positive intention. So let's try to see if we can find a positive intention. Like the example that I have in the book comes, it's a real thing that I've heard once in Japan. So the person was upset that the construction contractor billed for a higher amount than agreed to do a specific repair in the house. So what could be the positive intention for that? So the intention might be that he wanted to make sure that the house would be solid. It would be in a good shape. And that would be the heart of the positive intention. Yes, he did ask for more money, but it was based on wanting to have things in a better shape for the people who were hiring him. So again, I'll speak with Jean and see if we can find together what could be the positive intention of that colleague. And then I'll leave sometimes to all of you to do the same on the situation that you're working with. So you have the mic again. Maybe it could be helpful also. One of the basic principles of NVC is that every action is an attempt to fulfill a need. And the key word here is attempt, because, and this is one of the things that was so insightful for me when I started learning NVC, reading from Marshall, the clarity that we don't always succeed. Our intention, like we don't always manage to successfully move from intention to impact. So there's an intent, there's an intention, and does that work? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. So it's like, for me, it's like the stock market. We invest in a company and we hope it's going to go up, but we don't know the future. So it's the same thing for us. Like people do things, oftentimes there is some positive intention and it doesn't always carry out. So Jean, could you think of anything positive out of that behavior of this colleague? What could be positive intention?
I'm thinking right now that when I hear him doing this, I sense a lot of frustration. I think if there's a good intention, my guess would be that it's for a deep desire and longing for contribution and competence for himself and for others.
Yes, thank you for that. It makes sense to me that through, you know, what Marshall would call a tragic expression, blaming or jackaling or type of language that you're not happy with, under that, this might be the best vehicle that he found to try to contribute or to build confidence for himself. And oftentimes, I would say people that are quote-unquote complaining, there's a desire for empathy and to be heard. And I think many people have very, very little space to be heard and receive empathy aside from the NVC communities or like-minded groups. So it's often just this deep desire to be heard for what is frustrating for them. Does that make sense?
That really does make sense. And looking at your document here, I also noticed that I've moved through these other two phases before as well, that I've attributed negative intention to him in terms of his, you know, this being something that he's doing to upset me because I've spoken to him about it before. And I've also moved through neutral intention, though. He just made a mistake, you know, he's just having an off day now. You know, we've talked about this. I totally can see how these three different phases fit in the situation.
And so you can see that it's helpful to increase our awareness about what type of intention we attach to the situation.
Yes, it's very, very helpful.
Because we do it immediately, right? It's not even a split second. It's immediate. Someone does something and bang, here's the intention is attached to it. It feels like the truth, so to speak. So that's why I want all of us to increase the strength of our muscles of discernment around that. Yeah. Thanks. And I'll come back to you again a bit later. And for others, again, just a couple of minutes. Try to find what is the positive intention of the person that you're upset at. For now, a couple of minutes with music again. Let's move to the next step. We continue the opening of our hearts through the phase that I call rehumanization. And the way I'm seeing it is when we're upset at others, or we have an enemy image of them, they sort of lost their humanity. And in some ways, they became a thing. It's almost like moving from 3D to 2D. They are kind of flat. And I believe that's why people can do all sort of things to other human beings, because they don't experience them as human. They experience them as things. They know that they're human beings, but still they experience them as things. They lost their humanity. And one of the things that I'm most excited about what Marshall brought in terms of NVC is that through the feelings and the needs, we can bring back people's humanity. Simply by associating feelings and need to a person that we have lost humanity in relation to them, suddenly they can come back to life. Because a thing doesn't have feelings and needs, as far as I know. Maybe they do. Typically, I don't think so. I'm open to everything. But a human being has feelings and needs. So when we attach guesses of feelings and needs to a person, we can bring back their humanity quickly. That requires conditions, that we add sufficient empathy, that again, physically, we have enough strength, that we have the skills, we have the consciousness, we want to do it. There's all kind of other things around, but when these conditions are there, then it can make a huge difference. So let's try that with you, Jean, again, to illustrate for others. And the question I have for you is simply a little bit like we did with you, what do you think could have been the main feelings present for your colleague in that situation when he was using language that you don't enjoy and for a long time? And you already mentioned frustration, but is there something else?
there might be something more going on there for him. When I think about the actions that he takes, you know, the banging on the keyboard, the language that he's using, you know, there might be something deeper there for him that I really haven't connected to, other than what I've seen, you know, my guess, which was before, which was, you know, sort of a deep frustration, and upset, and, you know, just the sort of general need to contribute to the project at hand and to be seen as somebody that's, you know, competent and able to do their work.
So it's very insightful to hear you say what you say, because oftentimes when I work with people and I help them dissolve their enemy images, I tell them, look, this might be difficult, might be impossible for you to do. So it's, again, not the direct trajectory. Anything can stand in the way, and it all makes sense. It depends on a lot of factors. So what I appreciate from you, Gene, is your clear willingness to look into it. That's already, for me, just a beautiful movement of the heart. Say, look, I'm thinking that there's some other things that I didn't see yet. You're already out of the separation mode. You're already going towards the heart of that person, even if you don't have the answer. That's all I want at this stage, that we make that effort of opening. And sometimes, like I said, it could be very difficult. And one thing that I'm wondering, is it possible that this person might be experiencing some kind of a even deep helplessness, like a sense of powerlessness on how to impact his world? Is that a possibility? Like I said, I don't know, just something that came up for me.
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a lot of helplessness, a lot of powerlessness, very wanting to be able to have power in his world, wanting to be able to maybe be safe about his employment.
Yeah.
Maybe some sense of deep fear that if he doesn't do well, he's going to lose his job, or, you know, lose face, or something else.
Yes.
Sometimes I wonder if there's something else even deeper there by his own inner beliefs about who he is and what his value is in the world as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, we could certainly go deeper. And at this stage, what's really important for me to rehumanize people, actually the feelings are more important than the needs at this stage. Once we can see that the person could be scared, it doesn't matter if it's true or not, but just seeing that person can be scared or alone or upset, we can relate to it. We talk about the universality of needs, but there's the universality of feelings. We know how it feels to be scared. And that's when we are engaged in this highway of compassion. So let me check with you. How does that feel to you? I've done the exploration with it together. Does that impact the intensity of the enemy image you have? Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't, but oftentimes that already creates a shift.
Yeah, I think so. Hearing some of the reflections that you gave of your own guesses about what might be going on for him, the feelings that he's having, I think it does open my heart to more possibilities that what he's experiencing and being more connected to that experience, because certainly I've experienced those things myself too.
Yeah, right. So it seems like it feels softer around your heart in relation to that person. Yeah, more soft.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. And same thing for all of you. Couple of minutes. Even if it's difficult, give it a try. I think it's really worth it. I mean, if it's too difficult, like just don't even go. You probably do something too hard. But if you can explore, trying to see, and you again use the list of feelings and needs, what might have been going on for that person in terms of feelings first and then needs in the specific situation that you're working with. Okay, so hopefully you found a couple of feelings and a couple of needs, and you let yourself being impacted by being in that space. So the next piece is now we're shifting to opening our mind, like fully. We've had some of that, like when we were thinking about the intention, we need our mind for that. Then. But now it's a different phase. So that step is called meaning. And what I mean by that, and this is the way I've heard it from Tony Robbins, who's a self-help guru in the United States and many places in the world. And I was listening to a CD from him through which he talks about communication. And here's what he said. He said, "We only feel pain in relation to the meaning that we attribute to a situation, not in relation to the thing itself." So we don't feel pain in relation to the thing that happened. We feel pain in relation to the meaning that we assign to a situation. And that's the thing I was talking about that for me is so crucial. Like I want all of us to become master of that. And that's another thing that we assign immediately. Something happens and we assign a meaning. And what I mean by that is that it's some sort of conclusion that we have about the world or ourselves or the person, but usually it's about ourselves or the world. So one thing happens and we create a conclusion immediately. And then it's that conclusion that stimulates pain. And I coach my son around that specific thing of meaning where he wanted to declare that he wanted to go out with a young woman a few years ago and he was really nervous about it. And I told him, look, the only reason why you would feel bad if she says no, it depends on the meaning that you attribute to her no. If the meaning is that it means you'll be alone for the rest of your life and girls don't like you, of course you'll be miserable. But if you assign the meaning that it's just not a fit or it's not the right timing, you'll be fine. So it's very tricky because of the speed in which the meaning is assigned to the situation. And I would say it's essential for our well-being to train ourselves to distinguish. It's very similar to observation and evaluation. It's different. It's a conclusion that comes from specific events. Oftentimes it will sound like it will never, or I will never, or it will always, I'll always be alone, it will never work, I'll never be loved. It's usually some kind of really deep and dark meaning that we don't see. We think the pain has to do with what happened, but in reality, it's because of the meaning that we attach to the situation. So let's check again with Jean. Can you think of any specific meaning in terms of conclusions that you attached to that specific situation with that person?
Thing that comes up for me is that I questioned whether or not I'd be able to enjoy work if I had to, you know, endure this kind of thing day in and day out. So what was the meaning for me was I'm going to have to endure this. Never going to end.
Yeah, that's a typical expression. It's never going to end. And we can go deeper in meanings. The other thing I've heard is that some version of the I won't be able to enjoy work. Yeah. Thank you. That really illustrates what I'm talking about. Can you see that there's a gap between this person talking using this language the way he's doing and this meaning that it will never end and that you won't be able to enjoy work? You get the distance between these two things, yeah?
Yeah. One thing is clearly an observation. The other one is what I'm believing, what I'm deciding these events mean to me.
And does it make sense that probably a big part of the pain has to do with the meanings more than the things themselves?
Yes, it does. You know, during the course of this relationship, I think that definitely when those thoughts were in my mind, I was definitely feeling, you know, discouraged, despondent, sometimes really just annoyed, and wanting just not to be around it and wanting to leave.
Sense. And I love the clarity of that and really appreciate the inner work you're doing and the precision of it. But what I'm getting is you said when I had these thoughts in my mind, it felt different. I was more discouraged. I didn't want to be around it. So that means that some other times you would probably be less bothered And it might have to do with the physical state that you were in, or any kind of other reasons. But it's, again, the distinction between the cause and the stimulus that we're looking at. And so the cause is in the meaning that we project to the things that are happening. So does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Yeah, right. Very much so.
Great. So again, I'll put you back on mute and leave minute and a half for people to try to find some meanings, conclusions that you came up with in that situation that could be the cause of the deeper pain that you've been experiencing around that. So let's move to the next step, which I call rewriting the story. And that's really when we can use our creativity, our imagination, our thinking abilities. I think we are often very skilled at finding the worst case scenarios and putting things together, building stories about sort of, you know, negative ways that things can unfold or have been unfolding. So let's turn that around. Let's use the exact same skills, but turn it around to see what could be the explanation that would make sense, something that could carry a different energy than that person, something wrong with that person, or they're out to get us. So that's rewriting the story. There's two parts to it. One is finding a potential misunderstanding. For me, that's really important because I know that about 80% of conflicts or tensions are caused by misunderstandings. The message sent, message received, there's a big gap between the two, and it happens so often, and that's a reason for a lot of, like I said, interpersonal difficulties. And the second part is to find a scenario that would lead us to have as close to no blame as possible for the person. Complete imagination, creativity. We have some clues, but we don't have the whole story. And that's very exciting to me, to be able to have that as in our skill set. The question is, what is it that I don't know? What might I be missing here? And as you would agree with me, it requires, again, the intention to do so. It's probably not going to happen by itself. So when we have the intention, we ask ourselves, is there possible that there could have been some misunderstanding in that situation? And what could be a scenario that would lead me to have as close to zero blame for the person? Let's play with Dean a little bit. So first, could you think of any misunderstanding in that specific situation that you were working with?
You know, I think probably the most basic misunderstanding I could think of really is that perhaps his values for language aren't the same as mine. Maybe, you know, he just really doesn't have any understanding about what my values are about that, or what even other people, other colleagues might see as values about respectful conversation and decorum.
Yes, I got excited hearing that because we know that the whole question of respect is very subjective. It depends on people and countries and cultures. And, you know, just burping here is not respectful. Go to China. I think it's, I've heard, never been, but I've heard that it's common and that it might be seen as not respectful if you don't burp. I'm exaggerating a little bit. But we know there's a lot of different things about respect. But language, yes. Maybe that person doesn't know the extent to which it bothers people, or maybe comes from a culture that this language is so ingrained that he doesn't have full choice around it. So I like that you went there. Now, in terms of scenario, can you think of a scenario that would lead to have as close as possible to zero blame with that person? And a scenario implies really things that you don't know of, but you would guess, like, what could be potentially happening that leads this person to behave in this way? We already touched on some of these things, like might be afraid for his work, wants to contribute, the helplessness and all that. But now let's move it to the next level of a scenario, something that really you don't know could be potentially happening. And I want to say, while you think about it, that it doesn't matter to me for this work if it's true or not. What matters is to do this work for what? So we can find peace in ourselves. The person is not even there now, at least. And if we can find peace in our heart, seeing the humanity, we feel better. And we are connected more to that divine energy so we can use our energy in a more life-serving way. We're not distracted. We don't lose energy being upset at other people, which I don't think is very life-serving. And when we do that, the next time if it happens that we see the person, we will be in a much better place to potentially engage with them. We don't have to, but we'll feel better around them when our heart is open to them. So did you find something, Gene?
The possible scenario here for me is that this person is doing this because that's his habitual way of communicating, that he doesn't really mean or intend to do harm by his choice of language, and that really this is something for him that's really about, you know, his own lack of, I don't know, value for himself, and about his own inner struggle with trying to perform.
Yeah, it's a habitual way of communicating. There's no intention of harming, just the way it is for him. It's connected to deep values of him. And also just a couple of other things, because it actually reminds me one piece of work that Marshall did in a group. There was a woman who was saying that his husband was always late, and she was really bothered by that. And then Marshall's way of working with that was to ask her, so how could you see that as being the most wonderful thing that your husband could do? And it's very similar to what we're talking about here. I actually didn't make the link before. But the woman was like, what do you mean most wonderful thing? It's really, it's bothering everyone. I feel embarrassed. He's constantly late. With Marshall, what came out is that his husband was someone who was always, let's say, most of the time prioritizing others, was not connected to his own needs. And that led him to go in quite a bit deep depression in the last years. Marshall got that through asking questions to the woman. And what Marshall suggested, that why being late is the most wonderful thing that the husband could do, is that by being late, he's being less nice. He's less only thinking about others. It's not conscious, but in some ways it's a way to affirm his own needs by not doing what everyone wants him to do. And that was very insightful for the woman, you know, everyone in the room. And so that's why I'm thinking in this case, totally improvising along the same lines, maybe that person was shut down part of their life. Maybe the person he didn't say anything maybe for a while. And it was so hard to live this way. And maybe it led him to be in that place of deep struggles, and people were sort of pushing him to say things. Maybe this, who knows, 20 years ago, I don't know, that he now talking is already much better than being shut down for his own sanity. And even if it's not the best, that's still an improvement as opposed to being shut down and just stuck in his own world. And I'm curious, how does it feel for you to hear that possibility, even if, like I said, it's complete guess?
Well, I want to say I think that it's a good guess. I think that that's a very likely scenario based on things that I know about his life, just a little bit that I know about his life, and I think that's a really strong possibility that, you know, perhaps a lot of this anger and frustration is coming out of a well of hurt for him someplace in his past that he's still carrying around with him.
And what does it do to your heart to consider that possibility that the way he is comes from a deep place of hurt in whatever shape or form it was? What does it do to your heart?
For me, it helps me to relax. It helps me to feel more at ease when I'm around him, even though I can't make him change, even though it's likely that his language is not likely to change, even if he wants to for me.
Yeah.
I don't have to be in pain when he is expressing himself this way. And maybe I have other options. You know, maybe I can just walk away. Maybe I can just see the pain that he's experiencing and not hear the language.
Thank you. You were, as Marshall would say, you would not hear the words, but connect to the deep pain that he's been carrying. And that will change your experience from anguish to maybe compassion. And that, for me, is the almost like a miracle of how our lives can be changed through this consciousness, through opening our hearts. I just love that we also have this ability, and that the connection to someone's experience changes a lot how we feel, and that we could have more inner peace. So really happy to hear that. So to complete and also introduce the next call, let's move to the next piece now, which is to find the underlying self-blame. I believe that when blame goes outward, most of the time is to protect ourselves from a blame that we have towards ourselves. And it's not necessarily so easy to find. But in my recent experience and a lot of my own brainstorming and playing with my own world, I could pretty much all the time find something. And the example is a friend of mine who was very upset at the policeman who was hitting with some piece of wood a protester in Venezuela. And when we did all work, I actually partnered with Robert Gonzalez doing this work around enemy image with that person. And at the end of what we've done so far, Robert asked her, so is there any blame that you have for yourself in relation to that whole topic of someone protesting in Venezuela? And then she took a moment and then she said, oh my God, yes, I'm here in the United States. I have a great life and I'm not doing anything to help people in Venezuela. So that was it. That was the truth of what was under her anger towards that person. So let's try it with you. Can you think of what could be a self-blame that would be under the blame that you have or you had for this colleague?
Well, if there's a self-blame, it probably is my own struggles to use clean language and use language that meets my own needs for respect. Mm. That there's some sense of inner guilt about my own experiences with that. And being afraid that, you know, being around it, I'll do it more.
Uh-huh.
It's a tough habit to break when you're angry and or you're experiencing those emotions.
So you actually want support from your environment to help you move in that direction of aligning with your language, with your values, yeah?
Yeah, I think so.
And as you carry that longing, it seems like there is some version of self-blame around the struggle that you have around that and some guilt around the language. And I mean, we could explore. There might be also some guilt or self-blame around that you would want to keep your heart more open to that person or anyone who do things differently than you are. So there might be other layers that we could look at. That, for me, would be more the truth of the situation and something that is life-serving for you to work with. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so if I'm hearing you right, you're saying that, you know, there might also be some other things there about guilt or self-blame, about wanting to be open to another person. And I would agree with that, too. Yeah, there's definitely some of that there.
So then, and then this is what we'll do next call. That is the nugget. That is the goal for you to work with, just to be with that longing, how much you want to be able to open your heart. And I mean, and that's why you are on this course, and how much you want support. Do you want to have a supportive and inspiring environment for you to align your language and your way of living with your values, and then to craft some strategies out of that? Because this is the message under the blame for that person. Make sense?
Uh-huh, yes.
All right. Thanks so much. How do you feel at the end of this journey with me today on the call?
I just want to say thank you for allowing me to share this struggle that I've had that's been going on for a while for me. And thank you very much for some of the reflection and empathy I received tonight. In general, I feel a lot more, I have a sense of hope that I'll be able to feel more compassion for this person and their situation. And also, I'm curious about discovering, you know, the things that lie underneath for me for the blame that I'm placing on myself in the situation. So thank you for helping me to see that more clearly.
You're so welcome, and thanks so much for your help in illustrating this for others, and thanks for doing the work for yourself, and I'm pretty sure that things will be shifted when you see that person again. So thanks, Jean, and well, this is the end of our time. I guess I would like to conclude with hearing from some of you an expression of either how you feel at the end of the call or one thing that you got from the call that you think will be helpful. Let's start with you.
Yes, I did exercise with this level 3, but what's much more present in my mind is a difficulty that's like a level 10 that I've been struggling with for months now. And I really got some glimpses of the humanity, the possibility of revisioning this whole scenario that I've been suffering from. So that's given me some hope and encouragement. I can see how a part of it is creating my own suffering by the meaning I give it, and my own guilt, my own self-blame. I was like, oh yeah, I did that too. So, so thank you.
You're so welcome, and I'm really happy for you that you could engage with that level 10 in a little bit indirect way, because level 10 are really hard and complex, but that you could create a crack around this. I'm really glad it happened, and I think you'll enjoy already a bit more peace of mind and overall relaxation, at least a little bit around this. So,
yes, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
All right, thank you. So that's it for today. I feel really in some version of awe. Really, this is so meaningful to me. Please think about this. You have these documents. Practice it. If you just write down one situation after another, you'll see the skill can come really fast. And this could be really life-changing. That's it for today.